Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Organized in conjunction with Charles Marville, photographer of Paris, this symposium, held on December 6, 2013 at the National Gallery of Art, offers new perspectives on art and urbanism in 19th century Paris. An international panel of art, architectural, and literary historians addressed the transformation of 19th century Paris in papers that focus on diverse topics, including the representation of Parisian quarries in 19th century photography, painting, and literature, the formative role of architect Gabriel David in reshaping Paris, the use of photography to map the changing city, new modes of transportation that shape the experience and representations of the city, the impact of 19th century photography of Paris on 20th century film, and the relationship between Marville's urban documentation and contemporary photographic practice. The seventh and final lecture was given by Shelley Rice, Arts Professor, Department of Photography and Imaging and Department of Art History, New York University.
I want to sort of address one. My first statement is something for Holly, the idea that with age comes accretion. With age also comes some sort of perspective, which is really enacting itself for me today because I'm part of the sort of Molly Nesbitt, Anne McCauley. That's a particular generation of people, Françoise Reynaud, that I spent my youth with. And there were certain things that were de rigueur when I was working on things like Marville, like the idea that he was only a Paris photographer. But also there were certain attitudes. And sitting in a place like this with younger scholars, one sees the shifts and the changes that come with time. And one of the interesting things about this is that when I was writing my book, Parisian Views, and I refused absolutely to emphasize the political military nature of Haussmann. I acknowledged it, but it just seemed to me that didn't make any sense. And the amount of abuse that I got from my colleagues, who of course were the 60s generation and who were people who were very much invested in, you know, the bad politics of the man, those things were very much front and center in the thinking. And today I see there's been an emphasis on maps, on engineering, on the idea that these were engineering issues. And so, in other words, we're moving in another direction, which, frankly, I think suits Marville a lot better. But I have seen the change. Now, the other thing that I'm seeing in terms of perspective here, at the point when Marie de Thézy and Maria Maris Hamburg were working on Marville, when I was younger, it was a fairly radical thing, at least for a New Yorker, for an American, to look at somebody actually taking very, very seriously the work of a commercial photographer, of a person who, in fact, was working outside of the arts. In France, this was not a big deal. For us, this was something else. And essentially, framing Marville for us became our interest in old Paris. He looked like, you know, the prototype of Ache, et cetera. And again, one of the things that I'm seeing with Sarah Kennell's beautiful show and the book and the discussions that are happening today is, again, a movement away from pigeonholing him into being a documentary photographer of Paris or simply, you know, a nostalgic person, and moving toward a reframing of his work as that of an artist, with the complications, the messiness, the fact that the commissions, which, again, what we talked about when I was younger was he did before, during, and after pictures. And, of course, then we figured out that there are no after pictures, that lots of times the during pictures are absent, that, in fact, the systematic nature of this doesn't seem to have materialized. And also that there are these other projects, ins and outs, and various ways in which a life unfolds. So, you know, again, Sarah Kennell's show here represents a reframing of the oeuvre of an individual person who is going through the experience of living in a place that's being reconfigured. Now, I wrote my book, as I said to some people yesterday, that because in the 1980s, New York started turning into the money-making machine. It went from being the sort of, you know, the fallen, you know, the white flight city to the money-making machine that it is today. And the changes in my immediate environment were so profound that I decided to talk to dead people and see how they dealt with this. This is partly my karma, I think. I mean, you know, cities that are disappearing and being rebuilt seems to have something to do with why I'm here, because I just spent the summer in Beijing. where, of course, people are going through something very parallel. And I just finished writing the monograph of Xingde Nguyen, the photographer. And again, she's somebody who has thought very deeply about globalization and refurbished cities, because, of course, Beijing right now is being completely, all nature is being destroyed. The entire place is filled with skyscrapers. And again, my Chinese friends are having very different responses to this than, A, the French people like Marville, and also us today, who are seeing all of these things through a certain kind of fog that has to do with our historical perspective. So I sort of want to just, this is, I would say this is a work in progress, but this is a series, like Holly, I'm going to do a series of thoughts that I think are kind of relevant to frame some of these issues. This is, at a certain point, I bought like 20 reproductions of my favorite Marvilles from the Musée Carnavalet and the Bibliothèque Historique de la Ville de Paris. And I did that mainly because I wanted to write a children's book with cats going through the streets, but there were like no cats in these pictures. These cats were not going to sit for him sticking up his tripod. But the pictures are there for me to look at and to just go, I just go all like mealy-mouthed on. And again, one of the things that interests me about these pictures, and I'm now going to reframe them again, okay? I'm going to take them out of everybody else's little frame, including my own, and reframe my issue here. And that, again, looking at Marville, you know, he was a commercial photographer. What that means, and I've had a friend who's a commercial photographer said that he thinks it's harder than being an artist because you have your thing and you have their thing. And that somehow you are constantly negotiating the demands of the outside world and the demands of yourself. And that this is, in fact, a tremendously daunting task. And on a certain level, I like to see Marville that way. I do not and never have seen Marville as nostalgic at all. This is just not my reading of him. But what I always do see is almost, instead of being nostalgic, I see him almost as performative, in a very contemporary sense, and even though he was being paid by the city at this point, at that point, by this person and that person, that pictures were being used for various things, what links him to me in this case, where I'm going to talk about the Beijing artist, is the fact that he was literally boots on the ground. That all of these things we've been talking about, you have a framing of him. You can look at him as institutional, you can look at him as an artist, whatever, nostalgic or not. But the bottom line is that this was a man who lived through decades of a city that was getting completely wasted and then being rebuilt, or at least wasted in parts, being rebuilt, and certainly, and this is really significant, reconceptualized. And on a certain really basic level, Marville was documenting not so much the process, I mean, obviously he's documenting the process of these urban changes, but he's also documenting the experience of being the boots on the ground while time passes. Now, you know, in my book, and I still really think this, one summer I spent looking at about 800 Marville pictures in Paris. And that's kind of what I did for the whole summer. And I started hallucinating at a certain point. And not because the pictures are boring, okay? I mean, the pictures were, they are on some levels, as I'll show a little and as is obvious in the show, they are deeply repetitive, also what Min was talking about. He chooses a position. This may be, again, to three-dimensionalize, you know, to sort of embody maps, or it may be, you know, again, for other formal reasons that he likes. But on the other hand, what ends up happening by the fact that these pictures repeat over and over and over again is that I spent that summer feeling like I was in the middle of like a strange dream where time kept messing up. It was like he's got that camera there. He doesn't move, all right? But the stage sets keep moving around him. It's like he's marking space. And in that space, the space moves and the person not at all. So that my framing of Marville always in my own mind is that Marville is about the passage of time and about the experience, again, of being the boots on the ground of that time. And that this means that it's very hard to see Marville as somebody who makes one gorgeous image, and there are plenty of them upstairs, that I don't see him as a single picture maker. Even if the projects were years away, I feel like you see him in the spaces between these pictures as you see the stage sets of Paris shifting, that it's almost, again, like a performative practice. Now, a picture like this, the temporal complexities of what he's dealing with, they're really obvious in a picture like this. First of all, of course, we've been talking all day about the empty pictures that aren't. What Marville was, he's standing there, and the horses are going by, but of course we're not really seeing them. We're seeing ghosts of horses. So that, there's his time and what he's seeing, and then there's the time of the photograph, which is a disjunction. It's not quite matching up. So that you've got, on the one hand, that strange disjunction. This is a time that is not stable here. It is a time that is coming into being and coming into being in ways as strangely disjointed as the perspectives on the maps that were being set up just kind of to make things look smooth. And the pictures represent as well that same thing. Now let's see if this works. The other thing, of course, is the fact that there's another time period, since that time that Paris was literally coming into being again in that disjunction between his time and the horse's time. But also there's their time and our time. And we're sitting here in Washington, D.C., and a lot has passed between him and us. And again, a lot of what makes a serious artist and a lot of what makes a lot of people's concepts of Paris, of course, is this idea of the old Paris, the Paris that's disappearing, et cetera. And I think one of the things Stéphane made very clear is that, in fact, you had a lot of piercings that piece things together, and that Paris itself, in fact, did not disappear, and that there essentially what you're doing is an enrichment of a lot of levels of history. But our scholarship and our way of seeing and our way of living in cities that are constantly disappearing, like New York or Washington, this neighborhood, is in fact that we tend to see this with a kind of nostalgia and a way of, again, perceiving his time that was coming into being. So that all of these levels of, temporal complexity are working right here. Now, again, when I say that Marville, that there was this astonishing repetition in these 800 pictures, again, it's certainly with an acknowledgement, while I was doing my research, obviously, that he did a lot of different projects, the cloud ones being perhaps the most surprising and amazing. But also he worked for Blanquart Evrard. He photographed monuments. The Bois de Boulogne pictures are very, very romantic, and they do have a whole sort of freedom and a kind of just bucolic beauty to them that you'd never, ever connect a picture like this up with the person who did those 800 street scenes. And, of course, our street lamps. Again, there are a lot of different things. Now, the street lamps, I loved Holly's talk about these things, and, again, this idea of them as persons. I think they're as alter egos, Holly. I think that his way of setting himself up with a camera and being there and having things move and change around him, I think that's really a good perception, is the streetlights as human. Now, again, I'm just going to show you a few of my favorites here that I happen to have, Rue Jean de Beauvais. And again, just to emphasize what's always already been emphasized in these talks, especially Min was talking about it, the various ways he placed the camera. But again, one thing that, sometimes a street goes off to the right, sometimes a street goes off to the left. It's very, very rare that things are actually centered. He's a really good photographer. These things are really interesting. They move in a dynamic manner, which befits the photographer of circulation. I mean, Hausmann's whole thing was movement, as we've talked about a lot today. And again, the idea that what Hausmann was framing was empty space, and the buildings were getting built up around them, and the piercings were about the empty space, and he was very good at making that extremely clear, and the empty space was very dynamic. Here we go. This is these are often the same neighborhood. Rue de la Montagne Saint-Geneviève. This is down from the church that's at the top of this hill. Rue d'Aubenton, again, this is Latin Quarter.
I will come back to this picture, but here you have, again, a lot of ghosts, and you've got people sitting around in doorways, and again, the disparity between their time and his time, and of course, then that huge gap between his time and our time. Now here we have, again, seeing his work as a film of art history, seeing his work as, you know, again, one of the things that is, I think, it's a shame in the exhibition that there were no pictures of rebuilt Paris available. Because one of the things, again, about being Marville, artist or otherwise, is that Marville lived in narrative time. And that these pictures, you see a street, you see the one next to it getting torn down, you see something getting built up, you see an empty space, you see buildings going up in them, that ultimately, even though these are fragments of time that they are in, you know, in his work, just by virtue of the fact that he was a man on the street and he was living with these changes in these neighborhoods, and again, in my mind, these are performative pictures in the middle of these empty spaces that are about to disappear and then come to a different life, that there is a kind of narrative configuration. And again, here's some of the construction pictures that, again, use very, very similar formats. Here's some that don't. There we go. But again, like I said, when you're looking at 800 of these, what begins to happen is almost a film, and that you start seeing, you know, this guy who just stands there, and the world just starts moving and changing around him, and that it is very much about the stasis of him, the stasis of that camera, which, of course, is moving much slower than it might have to at this particular moment. And that around him is all of that activity. And, of course, what comes into being at the end of all that activity are streets like this one, which, of course, we've discussed already today, that have, you know, very strict ideas of how, you know, again, you zoom into deep space. And, again, I just want to mention that, of course, the trains were being built at this, you know, had just been built over the two decades before, and that, in fact, the concept of train space is a really huge player here, that you have the tracks moving down perspectivally, that you have those tracks measuring space as they go back, and, of course, what begins to happen in these empty spaces that are created by Hausmannization and piercings and everything else is precisely this sort of hyperspace effect and the sort of quick movement effect moving back into space that would have been something that people had habituated themselves with by the train tracks. Okay, and also, of course, seeing the city, since we've been talking about those maps, seeing the city as not a series of places, but a series of streets that get you from place to place. Again, the emphasis on the empty spaces that, again, get filled in on the sides by stuff that moves your eye along. Now, that is, whoops, there we go. Here's another. This is Avenue des Gobelins. Again, in this case, it's not streetlights, but trees that are somewhat taller than humans and a little less human-like than the réverbère. But again, they're moving your eye back into space, the idea of that movement being very central. And of course, there's Marville still sitting there in the middle looking down. Now, this is, you know, I spent a lot of time, again, looking at what happens, because as Marville, who again in the fantasy I'm having while I'm sitting around in Paris for 2 months, he's not moving, you know. The man is standing there and he's staring and he's looking down streets and he's looking at things. And of course, in the time that it took for these 800 pictures to be made and in the time that it took for me to look at them, essentially what is happening is that world, at least, again, imagistically, bear with me, I know part of it's still there, including the Rue d'Aubenton, but that world of incredible density of street signs, of human beings standing in doorways, of signage, of, you know, that incredible claustrophobia of those streets with no sidewalks, and also the sort of runoff of the sewers and everything, good, bad, and indifferent, streets with very little light, but the density of a kind of human habitation that is marking a place gives way to this. Okay, it's a very, very different conception of urban space. And he is literally bearing witness to, as he stands there, again, in my mind, in the same place, and things are just going on around him. But he is bearing witness to something very that is coming into being, okay, to a really significant changeover in the nature of his world. That's where I want to sort of leave him and move to the Chinese. Because right now, I mean, I don't know how people are, I don't know how they're living with it. I was so anxious, I was falling apart when I was there. Essentially, there's been a decision, as everybody's heard about, you know, that basically the Chinese have decided to modernize their cities, that a lot of natural things are being destroyed, that the old hutongs, and of course you're sort of seeing the rubble of one of them, that are being completely, you know, not completely, there are some left. They're usually being used for tourists. Again, you're moving into that strange world of modernity where people decide they want to move in that direction, but the old stuff is nice and tourists come to see it. And so, in fact, they're leaving some of them there that basically are crowded with Starbucks in pagodas and, you know, Starbucks in old Chinese-like buildings. But on the other hand, you also have, like, areas of the city where people want to buy condos that are fake hutongs. So they're newly built in the middle of skyscrapers, and they're newly built with new materials in the old style. So the temporal disjunctions are astonishing. And that basically the decision was made. And what's interesting is that nostalgia is something manufactured by Baudelaire and his compatriots. You know, and it's not like people... I was teaching for a while in Turkey, and it's like I would start in with nostalgia, and my students would look at me like, what's wrong with her? This is a particular way of living vis-a-vis time. And what's interesting, again, about being around my friends, I can't speak for everyone, is that this is accepted as something that is happening right now and that probably is better for them than the old thing. And so the constant destruction, I mean, it's just so dusty you can barely breathe. Everybody's already heard about the pollution off the charts. And your whole world is filled with enormous skyscrapers. Now, again, like I said, I'm a New Yorker, and I'm like, ugh. This is not necessarily the response of the people who are there. But again, there's one thing I do want to say, and that's that my friends who I'm talking about today, they're artists. All right, and again, you know, In photography, one has various relationships to the economic world, the social world, again, and they are defined by the situation you're in, but they're also defined by, you know, the economics that you're in, et cetera. But in China today, and again, the artistic movement is something that was sort of built out of various movements in the 1980s and 1990s, that it was a deliberate way of not being part of the official world that artists had been part of before. And it has always uneasy relationships. But it is a way of speaking a personal truth that was not necessarily something that I would, A, would have been available, or B, particularly desirable for Marville. Okay, that photographers establish relationships with their environments. And I'm the first person I'm talking about is not Chinese at all, and that's sort of my point. These pictures will remind you deeply of Marville, and they're by Tse Chung Leong, and he is half British and half American. He lives in New York. He was born in Mexico City. He went to Harvard as an architect. He's a tremendously interesting man, and he decided he wanted to go back to China, and he's been doing this for the past 10 years or so, and just photograph, basically do a Marville, color photography, very large scale, beautiful prints. But again, this contrast between the old and the new, that thanks to Marville, has become part of our lexicon of making art experience. But the other thing I want you to notice about the way he's working, and this is an American in the New York art world, trained at Harvard, and he is taking on, again, these overviews that we like, that the French loved in their maps, that we love and the way we try to frame Marville. He's taking on that particular perception and giving us these enormous panoramic views that, of course, became so popular in Hausmann's City of the panoramic overview of a city. And showing you, again, these immense contrasts between the old villages that are slated for demolition that, of course, by now have turned into Microsoft, you know, or Caterpillar. I mean, I would wake up in the middle of the night and these Caterpillar would loom over me. And again, you're watching, you know, again, these contrasts between the old and the new in the form of these really, you know, many of them, these immense panoramas, okay, that, again, do not involve individual people, oftentimes too far away to really have individual people in them. Here you go. There's some hutong. And again, this is what this becomes, okay? I do have, this is old and new Fengdu and the new, okay? That, you know, essentially there's both and there's what this becomes eventually. And so we really are talking within a very short space of time, an incredible revamping of physical space, of people getting used to cars, it's an astonishing thing. Also economically, it's just, I mean, everything about that place is astonishing and, for me, incredibly scary. But again, I'm not Chinese. Now, on the other hand, my Chinese friends, all right, the ones I'm going to talk about here, they don't do panoramas. That, again, one of the things about a very specific philosophic position in China and part of sort of Chinese thinking practice is that, you know, it's particular time, particular space, my truth. That, again, that everything is about all human beings exist in society socially, that you and your body and behavior are exemplary on a certain level of your attitudes toward the larger environment, that the role of art making or self-expression is very much to express truths about that environment. So again, the panoramic overview, the moving back into objectivity, the framing in large-scale senses is not what they're doing. These are wonderful photos by Zhang Dali, and again, he did a whole series called Demolition Series. And he would walk around to the places that were slated for demolition, like this area right outside the Forbidden City, which you can see through there. And he would go in as sort of like a graffiti artist, like Banksy these days, and he would cut out these self-portraits, or he would draw self-portraits. And so again, I'm connecting him very significantly to Muybridge, okay? Because again, this is deeply performative art. Again, the idea that, you know, or connecting him to Lee Friedlander's self-portrait in that way. He makes a performance. He decides this place is going to be destroyed. And again, people get their pink slips. You know, there's signs on the doors. And, you know, everybody's got to move. And, you know, there's a lot of chaos. Again, if you watch Chinese films, you can see some of that. But he would, again, go into these areas, you know, work with these self-portraits, which, again, through his head, what you can see is the Forbidden City. What you can see is old China. He is impressing himself on what is about to be destroyed so that the destruction of this particular wall and its transformation is also a personal transformation. So the performance takes place when he goes and does his thing at night, but the performance also continues, of course, at the point when the city comes in and destroys him. So again, I find very strong parallels between his work and Marville's on this level of performance that interests me. Here's a few more of his. This is all from his Demolition Series. And again, the contrasts, you know, again, you can see, as you can in Leung's pictures, you can see the contrasts between the old and the new. But the bird's eye view has been replaced by the fact that his face is there and what's being destroyed is him, as well as the city fabric, that the fabric of the city is the fabric of him as well. Now, this is Xing Dan Wen, and again, I just finished working with her, or we're in the middle of getting a book out. And Dan Wen has done a whole series called Urban Fictions. It's been going on since like 2004. And she got obsessed with the models. Now, Dan Nguyen was my student in New York. She has lived in Europe. She was married to a German. You know, she hangs out with somebody from Rotterdam now. She's spent a lot of time in Amsterdam. For many years, Dan Nguyen's been all over the place. Her perspective is very global. And is not a local perspective, and she really brings something to that. And she started watching as Beijing started changing. There were all these, like real estate agents, and you buy your apartment by going in and seeing these big models, and then you choose where you want to be, and then you buy the space, and then they build it. And these companies have names like Soho. You know, they have all these like, you know, Chelsea, you know, the companies that are selling are basically, and again, the thing that's astonishing about talking to people in China at this point is that they're living in the middle of this and they're deeply conscious of it. That this is not an unconscious, overwhelming process, that it's like, oh my God, look what's happening. They're selling us a dream. And the idea that you dream the next era is very much in evidence here, because what they understand is that the whole country is selling a dream, that it has decided to become modern for a reason, that essentially in selling an apartment, what you are selling is an entire way of life. And that what's being sold here, again, connecting this up to Marville with what I'm saying about the city as a stage set that keeps on changing all around him, that basically what Dan Nguyen understood when she was looking at these things, because she's bought several of them, is that what you're buying, you know, is your stage set. You are buying a framework within which your life will be enacted. That everyone she knows and all the people behind her will work within this, and that the walls of international style buildings will be the walls that frame her experience, that frame, you know, again, her sociability. And that essentially, I think the consciousness that one is walking, what she has a piece called sleepwalking, walking into a dream that will then be enacted in the physical world when the apartment that you bought is built. Now, again, she takes these photos, you know, of these models that people are buying, and then that's her. So, again, when I'm talking performative, again, like with Zhang Dali, I mean it. Her body is right in there. But this is all digital, of course. And essentially, you know, what she sees, you've got all these pristine white apartments, and she's just killed her boyfriend. So that her way of enacting, you know, again, these small, you have these immense spaces and tiny bits of people with tiny things going on, sometimes tragic, very often lonely, and that this, again, is the dream into which she and her friends are putting their body and their lives. Here we have, again, these are often her, and here people separated by walls, and the hutongs are very much set up in a different kind of way. Almost done. There's Dan Nguyen again. And I just want to finish with a very young person, Sao Fei, who actually, this is on the internet, it's RMB City. RMB City, of course, it's like money, their money city. And she actually built a city. There's the construction workers. There's the Marvillian construction workers in Second Life. So that, in fact, you're talking about this parallel building structure of this city being built all the time, being bought. You buy and sell things. And then, of course, what she does, very similar to Dan Nguyen, but completely disembodied, is that she and her son walk around and live in it on the internet in Second Life. Anyway, thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.